Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you. Welcome to Real Recovery. So glad you're joining us. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Billy, how are you?
I'm good. You know, I was thinking about your athletic career. I know you were in ninth, when you were 9 years old, you won the punt, pass, and kick competition. But I also know that your parents were very supportive, and your parents would sometimes say after a game, although you didn't score a goal, you scored a try. And that was meaningful, wasn't it?
Well, you know, they always were there for me, Bill. And I don't want to deflect away from God talking about my talents. And I just, you know, that's not the purpose of the show. You know,
I get that.
I feel like I'm on a California beach rock show from the 60s.
I'm with you.
Hey, yeah. I was talking to one of my friends who's a Christian, and we were talking about the godlessness in the last days in 2 Timothy chapter 3.
Okay.
And I want to read that, Bill, because I was thinking about my own recovery and guys I work with, and we'll pick it up in chapter 3, verse 2. For people will be lovers of self, got that one. Lovers of money, that's me. Proud, yep. Arrogant, yep. I don't think I'm abusive. Disobedient to parents, definitely. Ungrateful, yep. Unholy, heartless, unappeasable. Never happy.
Yeah.
Slanderous, yeah. Without self-control, yes.
Okay.
Brutal, not loving. Treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit. Yeah, I think so. And then the big one, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And I think when I work with guys, one of the things that I think is really important, Bill, is that we find ourselves in Scripture, that God's talking to us, and we can identify things like this, that, hey, that's me. That's me. And I don't know anybody that parts of that doesn't relate to. Fair?
Fair.
Lovers, pardon me?
Yeah, no, absolutely fair.
You know, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. I think that kind of hits all of us. And when I look at somebody in recovery, we talk about we need to make our recovery better than our using, but we don't want to have it like our using to where we're not doing our obligations and that's all we enjoy and that. And I remember hearing somebody said, if I don't like it, I don't do it. And that person was me. And, and the problem when we're in recovery, Bill, if you got into addiction, your best thinking got you there. You really don't know what you want. You don't know what's good for you because what you really want to do is killing you. And it really gets you into a place where you're beaten into a state of reasonableness, where we really have to surrender to God. And what that means to me is I'm out of the decision-making business. I give up. My best thinking got me here. My first thought is usually wrong. It's a reactive rather than a thought-out response. And when I read this, the godlessness in the last days, I really think it's written to us.
Again, I am aware that, like you, and I appreciate the fact that you say that your best thinking got you there, because I look at guys in recovery that I work with as well and realize that they're sitting in a recovery room and they sometimes say, I know how I got here, but I don't know how I'm going to get out.
Yeah, and the truth is really hard to swallow. And what I always look at for me, and for my guys, I don't ask my guys to do anything I'm not doing. How's that working for you?
Yeah.
If that's really what you want to do, how's that working for you? And I think where we get into trouble is we try to be God in our own lives, where we try to make our decisions go for our desires. And the book of James says you don't have because you don't ask. Mm-hmm. I think we have to go to God for everything, looking at our decisions, help us to keep walking with him, because he says, apart from me, you can do nothing. And for me, when I was reading this, I was thinking, yeah, I kind of let go. Yeah, God, help me to do this. And then I'll go, well, I can take it from here. Mm-hmm. I got it. And that's when I get in trouble.
Yeah. George, we just got a couple of minutes before we go to break, but I would love for you to remind us of step one.
Well, step one, Bill, is we admitted we were powerless over drugs, alcohol, and our life was unmanageable. And we really look at that in trying to get sober. We don't even want to do it. We have to get honest and say, hey, in an ideal world, I'd be able to continue to do this and not have any consequences. So it's really plan B. But what we learn after a while walking with God, not only was our whole life wrong, our whole attitude was wrong. I try to tell my guys when they're in rehab, you should be grateful that you're here. A lot of people don't get this opportunity. Now, that's hypocritical, because when I was in there, I wasn't grateful. Come on, you know?
Right.
And
right.
But that's really what it is God is allowing us to do this. And I try to read the Bible not as a set of no's, but as a set of things that I can do rather than what I can't do. And it's about being closer to God and doing his will.
Mm-hmm. So when you get past that realization that that you are out of control and that you need to be restored to sanity, that's that brilliant first step, that act of desperation, that unless God intervenes, I'm stuck.
Yeah, totally. And the good news for you is if you think that you want to change your life, but you don't know how to do it, God has already entered it because you didn't want to do this a little while ago. Everybody else who knows you thought you should do it, but you didn't want to. And once you decide that you want to change that, really the Holy Spirit is working on your heart. And you should take great joy in that.
Yeah. All right, George, we, like always, have got a great show coming up. We're going to take a little break and bring on our special guest, Jonathan, who's here with us in the studio. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George, and Ryan's on the board as always. I want to say a little special shout-out birthday to Charisse. Happy birthday. So after a short break, we'll be back with our special guest and lots more Real Recovery in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. So glad you're with us tonight. I just will let you know that George, my co-host, will not be involved in these three segments. So there's a good chance that these three could be 33 1/3% not as good as usual. So that's the way it usually works, because George is awesome. And we're missing him, of course. My guest is Jonathan. He's right with me here in studio. And let's meet him right now. Jonathan, welcome.
Wow, thank you, Bill, for having me here.
Absolutely. Now, I want to let the audience get to know a little bit about you growing up, where you grew up, what life was like, what family life was like. Was there, did you pay attention in school? Did you play sports? Did you go to church? All that stuff.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yes, I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. Compton, to be more specific. That's where I spent most of my time. Raised in a single family home. My mother was raised myself, my older brother and my older sister. I did not have dad around, but I had a lot of great father figures in my family, as well as in my my educators, my teachers. So that was helpful. Spent a lot of time in church.
Nice.
My mom is a devout Christian. She would have us go to the early morning services that start at 6 a.m., then the regular service at 8 a.m., then the service after that about 10:30, then after lunch a 1 to about 4 p.m., 5 p.m. service. And if there was something going on at night, we were there too. So I spent a lot of time in church. to the point where by the time I got old enough and I was like, I want to watch basketball games on Sunday. So when I turned 16, I'm not going to go to church. And actually, I kind of followed in on that. And perhaps that was the start of some trouble that headed down the road. But
that's a lot of church, though.
It was a lot.
That's a lot of church.
And especially when you don't have the thorough understanding of it. I mean, I'm still learning and figuring things out as an adult here.
Yeah.
So as a child, it was just like, man, what are you making me go? But I greatly appreciate her for it because it did give me a great foundation spiritually that helped, obviously, and continues to help. I made sure that I got my children, my own children, involved in church at a young age. And so I'm just kind of paying it forward with that. Not letting them, not having them go as often as I did,
yeah.
although they go to Christian schools. But I do believe that church is very important, especially at an early and young age.
So mm-hmm.
I support that.
Yeah. What about your own family, brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have an older brother. Should I use their names?
You certainly can.
All right. My older brother is Donald. My sister is Carlin. And they have each one child.
Nice.
My brother has a daughter, my niece Ashley, who has two children of her own. And my sister has a son named Carlos, who has a child of his own. And I have two kids, my daughter Sophia, who's 11, my son Jonathan Jr., who's 8 years old. And they're all great. I love my siblings. I love my mother, Josephine.
Mm-hmm.
I love you. She's definitely my rock, to be honest with you. I wouldn't be anywhere near where I'm at right now if it wasn't for her.
Mm-hmm. So growing up in Compton, of course, we hear Compton nowadays, and we think that sounds like a pretty dangerous place.
Mm-hmm.
Was it that way when you were growing up?
I would say it was worse when I was growing up, to be honest with you. It was when the crack epidemic really got onto the scene in Los Angeles and America. Gangster rap became a big thing with groups like N.W.A., entertainers or rappers like Ice-T, who's has a star on the Hall of Fame, on the Walk of Fame. And it was bad. It was tough. Gangs were at their peak. I recall Compton was considered the top five or one of the top five most dangerous cities, not only in the United States, but in the world for about a decade plus during my time of growing up. And I had people who were shot and killed like right in front of my house. I had a lot of tag bangers who would put graffiti on our house on a regular, pretty much every other day basis. And it was tough. And I think that's in part why my mom pushed my education to be at private schools. I think she felt much more secure. My older brother and sister, they went to public schools, and I think she wanted me to have a different experience, which I greatly appreciate to this day. In large part, not only for the educational aspect, but the safety and security.
Mm-hmm.
At least during that time. We know now that schools are a little bit different. No matter where you're at, you have the risk of danger.
Yeah.
But during that time, it kept me away from gangs and drugs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So. Jonathan, if everyone on the block is feeling this, threat, is there some community amongst the neighbors? Like, we're all in this together? And
you know what's interesting about it, Bill, and I appreciate that question. You know, things become normalized.
That's what I mean. You know? I think that's what I was
getting at. Like, you're so used to it.
Yeah.
You're so used to hearing about somebody that you knew who was shot and killed. I've had friends who've been shot and killed due to gang violence that you almost become, I don't want to say numb, but to an extent.
Yeah.
It's just your everyday run-of-the-mill activity and event, and it's unfortunate. And I have been asked that question before by others in different environments and situations, and it's pretty much the same thing. It was like, well, I didn't really know much different because that was what I grew up knowing.
You know,
that was the first quarter century of my life. It wasn't until I started expanding, starting to go to college at Loyola Marymount University, go Lions, and started to, really interact with people of various different cultures, socioeconomics, et cetera, et cetera. Then I started saying, you know what, perhaps dodging bullets every day wasn't a normal thing for one to experience. But I still take all those experiences that I had because they helped mold me as to who I am today. And I think I'm, to a degree, a well-rounded individual as a result of that.
Yeah. Say, Ryan, when he said go Lions, are we going to have to pay a royalty for that?
I think we're okay. I think we'll be good.
I paid them enough, by the
okay.
way.
So I just saw the way he snuck that in, and I thought, I didn't know if we're going to have to pay royalties.
Sorry about that.
But
they've been taken care of considerably for my attendance there, should I say.
So what was after school like? Was your mom working, and did you come home to an empty house, or was she there? Or what was life like coming home from high school?
Thank you. Well, in high school, K through 8, I went to an after-school program that was actually ran by the Salvation Army.
Sweet.
Believe it or not, it was like right across the street from my school. So I would just spend times there with play basketball, shoot pool,
yep.
do different things like that. In high school, that's when I started getting more involved in sports. I'm a big-time basketball player. I did go to a football practice, quickly discovered that I didn't like being hit by guys bigger than me.
Yeah.
I like baseball, but I got an injury when I played Little League, so that kind of made me disinterested. Basketball was my thing, you know, and I enjoyed that. Plus, I'm a bookworm. I'm a big-time nerd, so I like to bug my teachers after school to their chagrin, just trying to get as much of a wealth of knowledge and information and understanding as I possibly could about the world that I live in.
Where did this intellectual curiosity come from?
It was greatly encouraged by my mother.
Okay.
You know, also members of my family are all smart. It doesn't matter if they have this degree or that degree. You know, some more street knowledgeable than I was, obviously, but others just had more experience, you know? And mm-hmm. so I was always encouraged. I was the youngest one of my generation. So I'm sure my brother and my sister would say I was a bit spoiled or doted on,
yeah.
a little more so than the others. But I was always, you know, encouraged to pursue my education. And my mother took me on a lot of travels when I was young. We, on two different occasions, we traveled the entire continental United States. Once we did it by train.
Cool.
Another time we did it by bus. So Amtrak and then by Greyhound.
Uh-huh.
And got to hit up every state. And then she would let me get like a little collector's thing where it was like a pocket knife or something to document, you know, that I'd been there, done that. And that's what I try to promote for my kids too, allowing them to travel. Haven't had a chance and opportunity to do it as much because of COVID and other
sure.
things that have limited that. But I'm looking forward to the future. God willing that I'll be able to give them the same experiences that I
Yeah. So, Jonathan, as a guy who was pursuing education and you liked school and you called yourself a book nerd, did you get bullied by other kids?
No.
Wanting to be smart?
No, because I was also an athlete, too.
Okay.
You know, and I could hold my own in sports, and I was always part of the cool group.
So you're in the cool group?
Yeah. I was voted most popular and most likely to succeed out of high school and pretty much in college. I was kind of the big man on campus. If anybody disagrees, you could just recall. And I'm not saying that that's anything that anybody should aspire to be or do, because it comes with a lot of luggage and baggage as well. But, you know, I greatly value my life experiences.
Yeah. So I'm looking at your high school experience going, you done good.
Done fairly well.
Yeah. So was there any party element that showed up in high school?
In high school, no.
Really?
I think I may have had consumed alcohol once with my friends in high school.
Okay.
And that was our senior ditch day.
Okay.
I had a couple of drinks before with like my relatives. It was almost kind of more of a rite of passage type thing, if
okay.
you will. Marijuana. I tried smoking once again. I was on that same ditch day, and I was very dizzy and really didn't think I would do it again until I went to college and realized that that was not going to be the case. But in high school, no.
Yeah.
I was pretty square when it came to that stuff.
All right.
Fortunately.
So I want to talk a little bit about your continuing education because you were on a very determined path. But I also want to talk about how you started to find yourself in a pattern of using.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's start with your educational pursuits. Tell me what your goals were.
Well, I obviously wanted to make my mother very proud, and I was fortunate to get into a great university. My SAT scores, that's our standardized test in California, as opposed to the ACT out here.
Okay.
And I scored decent enough, I thought, for a guy who didn't really study for it or anything like that. And it was good enough to get me accepted into Loyola Marymount University. I always liked studying, like, history. I love studying, like, government, so political science became a good fit. So I got my bachelor's degree in political science there. I then was given the opportunity to become a charter member for a new program that they were starting called Place Corps at Loyola Marymount University, Partnership of Los Angeles Catholic Education. And I that's what got me started in my educational career. And after that, I got into teaching, and I went to a university in Topeka, Kansas, when I moved out to Kansas for a few years, and that's when I got into my special education point of education, and did that for a while, and then eventually got into a doctorate program at St. Cloud State University and graduated officially last May with a doctorate in education and administration.
Oh, that's impressive.
It was a lot of work.
You stayed focused, Jonathan. Way to go.
It was touch and go there sometimes. You know,
I bet.
It was during COVID. On top of that, I was also dealing with some personal life issues that kind of set things back, in my opinion. And it's costly. You know, education does cost. So, you know, it was a great accomplishment, but it most certainly came with some great sacrifices as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say I achieved that, and anything else that I had to deal with there is things are getting better. Situations are improving based on, you know, sacrifices that had to be made, or that were made, I should say, in that process.
Yeah. So let me ask you about how you found yourself doing some self-medicating.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Again, I didn't really do anything in high school. It wasn't until I got to college. I joined a fraternity there, and, you know, partying was a thing. We were the big frat on campus. And this was all a new experience. You know, I come from Compton, California, education and community, to now I'm at this grand university sitting on top of this hill overlooking the Pacific Ocean and Hollywood and Santa Monica and places like that, Marina Del Rey. And I'm meeting these very affluent guys who didn't look like me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were well connected and had a significant amount of resources as far as money, finances, and being able to just do things. And so that's when I got introduced into, you know, drinking a lot more and, you know, smoking a whole lot more marijuana. Other drugs never really appealed to me, and thank goodness for it. I just enjoyed smoking and drinking in college. But again, that's what most people, or at least the people I hung around with, were doing. So much like gang violence in Compton, to me, it was normal. I didn't really see it as an issue at the time. That happened later on in life.
So you found yourself getting into this group of guys that you were very drawn to.
Yes.
They were living life in a way that looked very appealing to you.
It was different. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was very different.
They had, again, access to things and life experiences that I hadn't had, or nobody around in my
lifestyle
community.
Lifestyle stuff. Oh, it's interesting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Big time. I mean, I got to see things that I otherwise, in all likelihood, wouldn't have saw.
Yeah.
At least at that time.
So. Yeah. Give me an example.
Well, you know, hanging out with the children of multimillionaires and billionaires.
Okay.
And being able to live, albeit very, very briefly, in their environments and dwellings.
Vicariously.
And yeah, living vicariously through them. I mean, yeah. I mean, nobody in my hood was driving ATVs on, you know, thousands of acres of their own family
property.
Being able to hunt and do things like that at their will. No, that was not happening where I'm from. Riding horses, doing all kind of cool stuff. That didn't occur where I was from.
Yeah.
So to be able to experience those, or, you know, driving fancy cars or going to these elite Beverly Hills like mansions and parties and stuff.
Yeah.
It was wild. Yeah. It was different.
Yeah. It sounds like a pretty crazy experience.
It was. It was. Yeah. But I, again, you know, despite some of the things that it eventually may have led to, I'm still thankful that I got to have them. Because what I did was I allowed some of my friends from high school who I knew weren't going to have those experiences. They hung out with me a lot at my university, and they got to experience those things as well. And they're things that we still talk fondly about to this day.
Yeah.
Maybe not the bad parts of it, but certainly the enjoyable ones.
Yeah. We'll take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery tonight, Bill, without George. So we're going to take a little break. Jonathan is our special guest here in the studio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. It's Bill and George, except George is not with us tonight, and we're missing him. But our special guest, Jonathan, is here with me in studio, and Ryan's on the board, so we're all doing pretty good. Jonathan, you painted an incredible picture of growing up in Compton, getting to this amazing university, rubbing elbows with some millionaires and billionaires, which for you was a pretty new experience, and I would say for most of us, it's probably a pretty new experience. But you also had some friends of yours from the neighborhood that were able to participate in some of that fun. And sounds like overall it was a good experience. But something happened along the way and you found yourself self-medicating a little more and more. Tell me more about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, when most of my other friends were able to stop once, you know, we got our college degrees and even me getting a little extra 2 years of it, and getting my master's, I didn't stop. I might not have done it as intensely as I did in college, but I would still drink. I would still smoke. And I, in my mindset, it was justified because I was like, hey, look at all these things I've achieved.
Sure.
In doing that. You know, I mean, I even interned for United States Congress, you know, between junior and senior year of college. So I felt like I had done things, certainly more than the people that I knew.
A just reward.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Besides, yeah. How are you going to relax otherwise?
Exactly. I mean, I didn't really, I guess, know how to. It'd been so long since I had been able to do it without using that stuff.
Yeah.
So it just became, again, just part of my habit.
Yeah.
That's why they call it a habit, you know. But I didn't see it as an addiction. I mean, I still had family and friends who drank. Unfortunately, I lost two uncles due to alcoholism. But I always just saw that as, oh, those were my uncles, and they just drank way more than they needed to and way more than I did. Not thinking that it was the progressive disease that it is. I just continued. We were in relationships where I was able, you know, intimate relationships with others that I was able to continue to do that habit with. And it wasn't, you know, to me, it was like, fine, I'm living it up. You know, I have a job. Things are going well and so on and so forth. Eventually, I wound up getting married to my college sweetheart and the mother of my two children. And I still drank, but it was my belief that I had it under control, that it was regulated. I certainly didn't drink around my kids. I wasn't abusive physically, mentally, verbally. I didn't get in trouble with the law or anything like that. I still held a steady job, and I was pursuing my doctorate degree. So, you know, what's wrong with a cocktail or two here or there? What happened, in my opinion, well, a couple of things. From the surface, you know, it was when a lot of the issues of social injustice were going on here in Minnesota, the Philando Castile killings, a couple of other guys during that time. And I was living in Wayzata, Minnesota at that time. And I was the only guy who looked like me in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm dealing with, you know, the frustrations of, you know, these incidents occurring with, you know, law enforcement and African-American men. And here I am, the only African-American man in my area. And, you know, I started feeling paranoid. Now, of course, I'd say that, of course, probably my using of alcohol and marijuana assisted with that. But I really felt like a man on his own island and that nobody could relate to it. My then wife was not of my culture. And I think that she didn't always understand where I was coming from. And perhaps it was also, too, me having the inability to explain it to her because these were just my lived experiences. And how could she, who, you know, wasn't experiencing the same things, fully understand what I was doing?
Mm-hmm.
So I was drinking more heavily, probably to cover up some forms of anxiety and depression, I'd probably say. I then got into a rehab program briefly, but I was trying to address the marijuana, you know, because, again, my drinking, I didn't consider it an issue. I had no DUIs or anything like that. But I was like, you know, I probably need to quit smoking weed. It's expensive, stinks, you know. If I can knock that habit out, I'll be good. Well, that wasn't the case. Because of my frustrations and other issues, I became estranged with my then wife. I actually got a job in the St. Cloud area while we were still living in Wayzata because I felt I had to just leave that environment. I really wanted her, she and the kids, to come with, but at that time she didn't want to. That was her prerogative, obviously. I would have liked it to be different at the time. But that allowed me to be even further away from she and our very young kids at the time. But I was going to school there to get my doctorate.
Yeah, you're working on your doctorate.
I was working on my doctorate. I had a job there.
Mm-hmm.
I had an apartment. I wound up getting an apartment there, too. But it just led to our marriage getting dissolved eventually. But I continued to still do my habits. You know, there's still social injustice issues going on. I was getting frustrated with my progress or lack thereof of my degree. And again, then COVID hit. And then that was like the cherry on top because now you're really isolated. Now you, by law, technically can't be around others. So, I'm just sitting here in my house or my apartment doing absolutely nothing. I might as well go get a bottle of something and go ahead and get some marijuana while I'm at it since I'm going to be here for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helped progress it to the point where it just got bad. And eventually thank goodness I have loving family and friends who were like, it's time for you to get that corrected. Let's you need some deeper, more thorough help. And so that's what I did. And I went to get the help. Can I talk about where it is?
Oh, yeah.
At the ARC Salvation Army in Minneapolis. And it's been my saving grace. Because while, yes, obviously I had a drinking and marijuana problem, that was just a symptom to a greater problem. I now understand that it was a spiritual malady that I suffered from. You know, when I made that agreement, or, well, I shouldn't say agreement because she didn't agree, but when I told my mom when I was 16 that I'm going to stop going to church now that I'm old enough to make that decision, I did. And even though I was going to a Catholic high school at the time and then eventually a Jesuit university, you know, I'd go to mass and whatnot, but it's not the same as having to be at church all day, you know. Didn't have to take it that seriously. Like, that's not my denomination. And even though when I was married, I had my kids go to church, you know, it was non-denominational churches. I still wasn't like trying to be a member of the church per se. So I was a Christian by name, but not necessarily always in practice. You know, I still prayed quite a bit, not all the time as much as I should, which is every day as many times as possible. And I think that that's what it was. When I was dealing with these issues of frustration, anxiety, anger, I wasn't turning to God or to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, to get help. I wasn't even talking to my family and friends about my problems because here I am, this guy who's now, you know, about to be doctor, and I should be able to have all these problems solved myself.
Right.
But that wasn't the case. You need help. You need assistance. And I'm just blessed that I was able to find it. And that's truly been my saving grace. And God willing, I will, well, my will as well as most importantly God's, I hope to maintain this course for the remainder of my life, however short or long it may be.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, were there some amends that needed to be made, and were you able to make them?
Yes, there were amends that needed to be made, and there are amends that still need to be made.
Okay.
You know, it's a process.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just get a sheet of paper and then just run to everybody's place of where they're at. And, no, timing is everything.
Yeah, right.
And I'm making a living amends with my ex-wife, I believe, and that's in part just showing up and being a great father to my kids and being supportive with her as much as possible, and I'm doing that. There's other people who I need to reach out to apologize for being the jerk that I could be at times when I was under the influence, shall we say. And so there's still amends to be made, but I have also made amends to others, too. And there's some people who aren't here anymore, unfortunately, that I just can't make an amends with because they're physically not with us on earth. So it's a it's a process, but I'm working with the great guy as my sponsor and support. And he helps guide me through that. And I'm hoping that I could be a sponsor to others and help them as they go through that process of healing.
Yeah. Always makes a big difference when you start working with guys, because every time we hear about someone who's relapsed, the question we always ask is, how many guys were you working with? And the answer is always zero.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's time and time the case. Because in order to fully heal and recover, you have to let go of your will. You have to admit that you have a problem. You know, denial is usually that biggest hurdle to climb over. But even if you get into a program like I was blessed and fortunate to get into, you got to have buy-in too, you know? And what a lot of people struggle with is the faith aspect of it. And to me, I mean, I'm sure that there's people who've recovered, long-term recovery, who aren't faith-based, but for me, it was the only way to reach for full recovery and to get it. You have to have your soul healed, because that's where most of the damage is done. Whether you had some childhood trauma, which I was fortunate not to have, although I didn't have my father in my life, but again, I had people there to kind of fill that role, so I didn't really miss that part. But, you know, the frustration of being divorced from the person who I had hoped to spend the rest of my life with, you know, that was traumatic for me. And, you know, no matter what titles I got or degrees or jobs or whatnot, I still felt empty. And it was because I was missing that spiritual component. You know, I wasn't praying. I wasn't reaching out to God and letting him know what I was going through. Yeah, I'd yell about it when I was, you know, perhaps intoxicated, or play the blame game, which most of us do, and say, oh, well, if this was this way or that way, then everything would be just fine. And I wouldn't have an issue with drinking because it would be good. I'd be able to do that and still function. Where, no, man, it's that spiritual malady. To me, that is the key component, just off of my observations and my own personal experience. I can always only talk about myself. Can't put myself in the shoes of others. For me, it was that lack of my faith being based. And even though I grew up as a child in the Christian faith, I left it and lost it and just relied on my own hubris and my own ego to get me through in life. And that clearly wasn't enough.
Yeah. Jonathan, one of the questions it's always good to ask is, who has that privileged place of authority in your life?
As far as?
Well, I mean, who has that privileged place of authority? Is it God or is it you?
It's God, clear as day.
I know it is for you now, but for a lot of people who are trying to find sobriety, if they're still on the throne of their life, they're having a hard time.
And it unfortunately happens almost instantaneously. There's been many guys who have left the program, and even whether they commenced or not,
yeah.
You know, they felt that they were going to be able to survive that wild, wild world, you know, outside of those doors. And more times than not, they quickly discovered that that's not the case. I greatly commend those who are able to come back to the program after experiencing that. I pray for the souls of those who unfortunately passed away before they could make that due to other usage. But again, you have to have that component. But it could be tough, especially if you don't have that foundation or if you still question it, if you're skeptical about it. That's why I encourage everyone to, you know, one, go to your class that I always look forward to on Friday, but really, really pray. Go to any type of and every type of Bible study you can attend. Go to any type of church service that you can go to outside of the requirements of the program, and really try to, you know, get in touch with your higher power, as they call it. I go to a centering prayer class weekly on Tuesdays. A gentleman named Glenn, he's amazing there. And that's the time where I literally get to meditate. It's no talking. It's barely even thinking. It's just letting things be. And that has been so helpful for me in my progress because, I don't know, to me it's the time when God talks to me.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it gives you a chance to slow your brain down, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes. Instead of always yapping like I'm doing and having the privilege to do right now.
I want you to yap on this show. You're the guest
yes.
of the show.
Yes, thank you, thank you. But, you know, you have to have a time of just quiet.
Yeah.
Try to find that serene place where you can just have a greater inner perspective on things.
Yeah.
Where you can find yourself, because that's certainly what it's done for me.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to guys in recovery, and they've referred to their brain is a monkey brain. It just does not settle down.
No.
It's all over the map.
And oh, yes.
If you don't get quiet and let the Lord speak to you, it's going to be hard.
Amen. And then you know what? You allow the good old devil to hop in there too.
Yeah.
And then he's going to tell you all kind of things that you shouldn't be listening to.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a little break. You listen to Real Recovery tonight, Bill Without George. And we're going to take a short break and be right back and hear more of Jonathan's story in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. I'm so glad to have Jonathan with me in studio, and we are hearing his amazing story. God has been so faithful, so good, and although Jonathan did walk away from the Lord for a while, that didn't last too long, and you're back.
Oh, hello, yeah. Hello. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious, Jonathan, because as you walk out your recovery, what does your walk out every day look like?
It's all-encompassing. Jesus Christ and the Father God. I wake up in the morning. First thing I do is I do a daily prayer through our Daily Bread app. I listen to you and other individuals, their podcasts, etc. And then I take a time out to meditate. So I get up quite a bit earlier than I technically need to, but I want to make sure that my day starts on that good note. If there's any other prayers that I need to mention about people who've asked individually, and I also pray for the group, the group as a whole. Then I just go about my day. You know, I try to stay in good shape. So I work out usually Monday through Friday in the mornings before I head out to work. And on the drive, I just, you know, kind of just think about, you know, where the Lord is guiding me, where I've been, not looking back on it like, you know, like Lot and them, but just, you know, just thinking about, you know, the opportunities that I've been blessed with having so far.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for sure it's because I'm spiritually found it, and that's my focus. As a person, as a father, as a brother, as a son, as a friend, I try to make sure that I put everything in the lens through my faith. And that's how I try to practice my daily life with the people that I interact with the actions that I make and take. I still have a silly side when I'm talking to my friends from, you know, back in the day, but I try not to make it too silly, you know. But I am just really focused. I am fortunate to get to participate in the services at the ARC, the Salvation Army, and also my home base at its Parkview, which is also a Salvation Army church. But I also, too, you know, will open up and expand to go to other places of worship, too, because you can't get enough. You know, I'm very curious, the historian that I tell myself I am, the theologian that I'm not really. I do like to see how people worship in other environments and different elements. And, yeah, just try to see if I feel that spirit, which I oftentimes do, because the goal should be giving all praise to God. So,
How has God been healing the parts of your heart that have been broken?
I think a fine example is just looking at the wound that I have currently on my nose. For those of you obviously who can't see because we're on radio, by the way, I was always told I have a face for radio, so this works out perfectly. But I had a procedure done on my nose yesterday, and they had to remove a piece of it to make sure it wasn't cancerous and all that. Then they stitched me up, so I look like the seams of a baseball kind of on my nasal area. But to me, it's also a great metaphor to recovery as itself. You know, going back to that spiritual malady, we all have these deep wounds, whether we come into a program like I did or you're still out on the streets. We're deeply wounded. Something or some things, many things perhaps, have happened to us that have made us lose touch with God, our spirit, our souls. We've just became worldly in our thinking and think that everything is just wrong and bad, usually pointing the fingers at our very own selves. And we allow that wound to eventually fester because we choose not to find the proper medication for it. We'll find other medicines. We'll become self-medics real quick, but we don't find the proper and appropriate medicine to heal these wounds. And so as they continue to fester, well, then when things become festered, they usually wind up dying out, right? They become gangrenous and eventually die, become dead. And that's what happens to those of us who are dealing with addiction of any type, sex, drugs, alcohol, whatever the case may be. We become dead if we don't get that medicine on time. And so I encourage anyone, male or female, who is needing help, or people who are family members or loved ones of people who are going through these struggles, to please, please reach out to them. Encourage them to go to places like the Adult Rehabilitation Center of the Salvation Army in Minneapolis, or any other place that can provide them service where they can get that spiritual malady cured, because then that'll lead to the mental healing. That'll lead to the physical healing, because you'll have that spiritual component healing as well. And that's what, much like the scar on my nose, I hope will happen, you know, that I'm using all the medicine that the doctor gave me. He's going to take the stitches out on Monday. And then from there, hopefully through time, the wounds will be healed to a degree where it'll look almost as normal as it used to be.
If you're looking to save some money, I'll take him out on Monday.
Oh, well, he told me it was pretty much already covered, but I appreciate
I'm just trying to...
I appreciate that very much.
I'm just trying to help.
Yeah, I think he's going to have some numbing medicine so it doesn't hurt. At least that's what I'm telling myself.
I can't offer that.
There you have it. Yeah. But I appreciate the offer.
So, Jonathan, when you take that first step into recovery, what is the hardest part about taking that first step? Do you step in going, I can't believe what I'm signing up for. I can't believe I could be here for 6 months. How do I do that?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, when I commenced from the program, my counselor, Lindsay, was like, she shared to the group a story of when, I don't know, I think it was like my second or third day in the program. I went to her office and I was like, all right, I think I'm good. I've seen what this place has to offer. I think I'm fine. I think I can handle all my problems on my own, which clearly wasn't the case. And fortunately, she and Amy, who's the case manager there, was like, Jonathan, she was like, just give it a couple more days. Give it a week. And if you feel that way still, then okay. Give me your walking papers, you know? So they gave me an ultimatum, and then I said, all right, I'll do my end of it, and I'll give a couple more days or a week and try it. And it would just hit me. Like, God just started showing me different things as to why that was where I needed to be for that time. And it's tough initially, I think, for, again, me, but from what other guys have shared, is you got to give up a lot, but you're going to wind up getting a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. You know, the first 30 days are brutal because you are really, like, detached from the rest of the outside world. Can't make phone calls like you used to. You can't contact family and friends
like you used to.
You
can't leave the building.
You can't leave the building.
Yeah.
And those walls can become very small.
For your own protection.
Yeah, for your own protection. And also to give you an opportunity to dig into yourself, because that's who you have to face into the mirror every day of your life.
Yes.
You have to start really thinking about what got you here, what circumstances got you here. And then, do you have the willingness to change? Do you really want to be transformed in a positive manner, where all the things that perhaps you've lost, you have the opportunity to at least regain mm-hmm. in some facet, which most importantly is your own dignity and your spirit. And I discovered that, and that's why I stayed the course. And all the promises that have been made in the Bible and in the other books I've read, they're starting to come to fruition. And I thank God every day for that. But what I also learned in the work therapy component of that is to not take these things for granted. You know, I've always been fortunate to get relatively nice jobs, right? I mean, I've went to school to do so, to get myself in those positions. But it was because of my hubris and my ego and my lack of spirit, I would just cast a lot of those jobs off. Having to work the work therapy program where I had to start busting suds or mopping floors or cleaning toilets, doing things that, quite frankly, I certainly didn't get a doctorate to do. Not that there's anything wrong with anybody who does that. I want to be known because I greatly appreciate it, and I'm thank goodness that I have had to do it and that I still do it actually to some extent in my new job and career. But it definitely planted that seed of, man, you better thank God for when he gets you back into a situation where you can, you know, build yourself back up, to don't take it for granted, to to be very humble, be very much at peace and thankful, gratitude for you being in that situation, because you can easily go back to the other.
Is it hard to remain humble through the recovery process?
Yes.
Say more about that.
You know, I mean, in part, you know, you always want to feel that pride, you know, which I know is one the most deadly sin of the seven deadly ones. But, you know, we use pride in a different terminology, I think, here in the States. And you want to, you know, get this award or that award, an excellent award, excellence award, or beneficiary of the week award and all that stuff. And you want to be top in something. You know, a lot of the guys were athletes, so we all are used to competition. And so you want that. But you have to say, no, my goal is to be humble, to be thankful for all the blessings, the roof over our head, the clothes on our back, the food that we have, our families, you know, the brotherhood. We have to be thankful for that. And that's what usually will bring us back down to earth, or brought me back down to earth, I should say.
Yeah.
And I'm content with that.
Yeah. So, Jonathan, we only have about a minute and a half left. I'd love for you to speak words of encouragement to people who are in a place of active recovery right now. What words of encouragement would you have for them?
Stay the course. Continue the journey. It's a lifetime journey. Keep that in mind. It's not going to happen overnight, but you will get there. You will see all the promises that God has made to you will manifest themselves. But you can't allow yourself to fall back into your past, because there's a great and bright future for you. So pursue that above all. And all those bridges that perhaps have been burned, you'll be able to rebuild them and walk right on over to the sunny side of things. But just keep your faith, keep your heart in God, in Jesus Christ, and they will show you the way. Do not fall back into your old habits, because they will kill you. Right? Because each and every one of you deserve a greater opportunity. We're all children of God and we're all saved. He promised us that. He made that happen. So let's take that gift and move with it, because we all deserve it.
All right, Jonathan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Bill. I greatly appreciate this.
It's been great. I know George has been missed tonight, but it would be great to have you back.
I'd be honored to do so. Anytime, you know that.
All right, that wraps up our show for the night. Thank you so much for spending time. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.